welcome everybody to our Comparative Urbanism series of the Great Cities Institute. We're very happy to have with us today Professor Alfonso Morales from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Alfonso teaches in the Urban and Regional Planning Department at Madison. Alfonso is a sociologist by training, is a PhD from Northwestern in that field, and has studied public markets and marketplaces from a variety of perspectives, both sort of theoretical and empirical work, where he's taking a look at everything from the sort of self-regulating aspects of markets, their sort of informal versus formal nature, the opportunities that markets offer for minority-owned ownership. He knows Maxwell Street Market better than anyone I know, has told me many stories about that market. In case you didn't know, is in the area of the South Campus development of UIC, just south of Roosevelt. On Halsted and to the east of it. He also co-hosts openair.org, which you could write down. You can go check out his website. It's a website on street vendors and public markets around the world. And I'm embarrassed to say that I've used it as a kind of tourism and traveling tool to find out if there's a cool farmer's market or a clothes fair market in the cities that I've been visiting. So Alfonso has 3 edited books to his name, more than 30 articles and book chapters, recently organized a conference and co-edited a book about Mexican-American entrepreneurship, and I was happy to find out that he's parlayed his knowledge about markets as sites of production and consumption into a very big USDA-funded project on regional food systems, also, as I just discovered, sort of going back to his roots in agricultural economics. So Alfonso's talk today is entitled Marketplaces, Prospects for Economic, Social, and Political Development. So I hope you will all welcome Alfonso. We're very happy to have you.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming, folks. I sure appreciate it. It's really delightful to be here. Not simply because I love Chicago and I love visiting, but because a lot of the sensibilities that have honed my intellectual life are embedded in several, but notably among us, one relationship. Dave Merriman and I have known each other for 20-odd years. He, in my master's program at UT Dallas, he was on the faculty of political economy there. And Dave has always been besides being a good friend, his way of thinking about the world, Rachel and I were talking about earlier, is really beneficial, and I hope that students who are here will embrace the kind of economist and economic thinking that he represents. Today, I'm going to talk about this article, which is now forthcoming in Journal of Planning Literature. Yay! Which is this huge review of the literature on markets, and I've got a file that I can email. And indeed, any articles that you want, I'm happy to send you PDFs. So, this gentleman, what's your name, friend? Hytham? Yeah. Hytham identified 2 out of 3 of these markets. Can anyone else?
Madison.
Yeah, it's just clearly Madison.
Madison, right, is Madison. On the left side.
Yeah.
Gosh, I know this spot.
Bremen, Germany, and Marrakech. Is the one on the right. The latter two on the right are World Heritage Sites, and for the applications for that designation, that the fact that they were marketplaces and have been for centuries was notable and an important part of that designation. Today, I want to talk a little bit about the history of marketplaces, talk about 4 types of benefits associated with markets, and those benefits I will sort of talk about them in the abstract a little bit and offer the JPL article for in-depth examples associated with those things. Talk about some options for planning practice for people who are actually interested in planning processes, something that is still relatively new to me but I'm learning to do. And then for academic research interests, 3 broad research questions. Oh, before I go any further, let me say one other thing. I really want to thank Rachel for doing the legwork for bringing me here. And something you should know about Open Air, which you mentioned, is that spammers are invading it a lot recently. So watch out for some of what you see on there, okay? There's some stuff that's a little sketchier, problematic. Anyways, but nonetheless, that web page has been pretty useful. All right, let's think about markets. This quote from James Boswell from the 17th century, or the early 18th century, is kind of interesting. I've often amused myself with thinking how different a place markets are to different people. Those who narrow minds are contracted to just supply and demand, view it only through that medium. But the intellectual man is struck with it as comprehending the whole of human life in its variety, the contemplation of which is inexhaustible, right? So if you substitute market appropriately there, you get the sense of just how markets and cities are incredible resources for thinking about human relationships of various sorts and chains of human relationships in various ways. So in terms of history, let me talk for a few minutes about three different things. One, how marketplaces fostered commerce and cosmopolitanism in early Europe. So a lot of the law that we know today, the lex mercator, the law of the market, came from, in effect, the creation of markets in early modern Europe, 14th, 15th, 16th century. So markets were there not just to establish commerce between places, but by way of establishing commerce, they fostered legal systems, not just law idiosyncratic to particular places, but systems of law that were fungible and adaptable and flexible and enabled people to do various sorts of transactions, economic and otherwise, across the very different social landscape that was early modern Europe. In the social sciences, this is particularly salient in the work of Georg Simmel, who at the early part of the 20th century and the late part of the 19th century wrote a number of articles, one of them, The Stranger, which chronicles how it was that people who were basically strangers enabled connections between groups of people, and how strangers themselves were enabled by law that suspended the xenophobic law that held sway in most jurisdictions at that time and earlier, suspended that law in order to enable trade and transactions across places. Now, in the United States, markets were really important. Until the latter part of the 19th century, marketplaces were the chief source of municipal revenue for municipalities around the country. They were the chief source of municipal revenue. And they were used for a variety of policy-making purposes, among them things like relieving unemployment, enhancing food security, incorporating new immigrants. You actually find this in policy reports that I've cited and work that I've done, but that you can find for cities across the U.S. Interestingly enough, comparative work helped establish markets in many cities in the United States. You can read policy reports in different cities, New York and Chicago, that say comparative work in the U.S. and abroad. That's what they say. Comparative work in the U.S. and abroad finds the importance of street vendors, of marketplaces. Now, you also get some distinctions in what we think of as a marketplace. In the early literature, and there were books written about marketplaces in the early 20th century, you get distinctions between fairs, which are periodic, perhaps quarterly, or annual or biannual trade shows, and you get markets, which are daily or weekly. They operate in different periodicities with different impulses, different economic enterprises involved, different consumer groups, different supply chains. So all these differences it's easy to face those differences in our contemporary scene, but for centuries, those were very important differences. Economists kept data on the trade in these different sorts of markets. And I will argue later, as I do to people in our Department of Commerce and the USDA in Washington, that we should be keeping this data again. That data was kept in the U.S. for some time, but has went out of fashion in 1920 and 30s and 40s, and which should become fashionable again. So, but what this talk is mostly about is marketplaces in the sense of daily or weekly places. They may be indoor, they might be outdoor. They might be privately established, as in indoor swap meets. They might be publicly established, as in city markets, like the city farmer markets here in Chicago. So this is about markets of that sort. Of course, in the middle part of the 20th century, there was a relative decline in the importance of markets, largely because of the relative increase in importance of storefront retail. But their reemergence in the 60s and 70s around many of the same themes. Immigrants took advantage of them. Food security was salient, as well as new employment. The prospects for employment or human capital formation were also important. I'll discuss those things a little bit. But also newer themes associated with things like food systems, what it is that it constitutes a resilient, an institutionally complete urban area, and the variety of niches in the ecology of urban areas that markets help populate. Okay, so the various kinds of markets that we have basically come from mixing different sorts of socioeconomic and political considerations. Historical, demographic, political, economic gives us sort of a picture. I'm not sure necessarily that I like this picture. It's busy, but get a sense of it. Marketplaces have histories. Chicago's Maxwell Street markets, 1860s, 1870s, for instance. But markets have histories, and those histories constitute the stream of water, right? Constitute an ojo. How do you say that in English? A spring. And those springs are fed in different ways. They're fed by these black boxes that the economists share with us, a supply of entrepreneurship, of risk-taking talent, of business interest. They're consumer demand, which again is a black box that unpacks in different ways. Rachel and I were talking about some of this earlier, actually. And activities that are non-economic motives for being in places, you know, being alone with others or being with a group of others in a public place. Or there's a variety of non-economic motives for being. Now, markets, though, we know even the most sort of unstructured or chaotic market, if we spend any time there, we see its constitutive aspects. And those might be through cities or other jurisdictions or larger constitutional or governmental processes, and certainly they can flow from the individual or collective goals that participants in the markets have. When you bring all these things together, they sort of produce this river from which these benefits flow. And this is the benefits and how planners might foster these prospects is the bulk of this talk. So here's a couple of pictures. Of course, you may recognize this is Roosevelt Avenue, the Walgreens that's down there. Now, of course, this photo is about a year and a half or 2 years old because Maxwell Street has moved from there. But again, from this milieu, right, you get different entrees, different perspectives as to what markets are. And so you can conceive of their benefits from a variety of perspectives. So among the economic benefits, and this is a truncated list. The JPL has a much longer list with detailed examples. Bless you, my friend. So invigorating underutilized locations. Planning Magazine, right? The what do you call that? The Women's Circle of Planning, or I don't know what you might call it. Y'all are familiar with Planning Magazine, right? Talks frequently about how markets, farmers markets, or public markets are useful for invigorating underutilized locations. There's a half a dozen, in just the last two or three years, you can find that in half a dozen places. In Planning Magazine's top 10 streets or top 10 places, markets are frequently on those lists. Employment and human capital formation. Instead of presenting you a table, let me just tell you a quick story. Whenever I was a vendor at Chicago's Maxwell Street Market in the late 1980s, when it was at its old location, in the early 1990s. A vendor that I knew at the market then, this 14-year-old young woman, has now earned her PhD in ag economics at Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and now works for Oscar Mayer in Madison. And when she moved to Madison, she emailed me and said, you know, I'm moving to Madison, you know, I'd like to see you. And so we visited, and what her parents told me in interviews 20 years ago about how the market, how working in the market fostered a variety of good personal habits and characteristics, but also helped people think about not just the activity of selling, but how that activity was linked in webs of other economic relationships that produce the supply chains and that make the vending possible. She echoed all those things whenever I just asked her, you know. So how did this help you? She said, well, I don't know if I could have done a PhD with just the habits of a regular teenager. You know, I don't know if I could have. So she couched her answers in just casual conversations with respect to the experiences of being in the market. So that human capital formation, I think, is something that it's hard, difficult to quantify, but easy to illustrate. Easy to illustrate. Business incubation. A number of very important businesses were formed at markets around the country. I don't know if anybody has a Phillips Van Houston shirt on. Let me go to an economist. They often wear expensive shirts. Made in Thailand. Bad answer, Dave. Phillips Van Houston, they started as street vendors in New York City. Right? Here in town, Alcalá's Western Wear, here on the north side, started at Maxwell Street in the 1960s. There are just a number of examples that economic historians and historians have written about, but some of those examples are discussed in the paper. Now, even if you don't incubate the next Alcalá's, right, what you do earn is a stabilizing second income. So the young lady I just described, even though she ascribes much of her success to the personal habits that were formed at Maxwell Street, she does say, well, I paid for a third of my tuition at Ignatius. She went to Ignatius High School, you know. And so from income she earned at the market as a child and as a teenager. So there's incomes there, investment incomes that are interesting to investigate. But besides those first three things, there's ways to promote local and sustainable agriculture. This is usually in tandem with land use regulations in different cities. I'll give one example of that in a little bit. And, of course, you can create a destination. There's an outfit here in the U.S. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of it. It's called the Responsible Hospitality Institute. Anybody ever hear of it? It's a fascinating thing. Look at it. It's a little nonprofit on the West Coast who is mostly sponsored by the four or five big alcohol distributors in the world, Domecq. Right, Don Pedro Domecq, the rum maker, the Puerto Rican rum. They're, of course, one of the humongo players in this field. So the Responsible Hospitality Institute took an interest in this work because of how it fosters connections to the nighttime economy, right? And how it is for them a way to civilize in some regards. A marketplace can be a civilizing thing, right? But even the emergence of historical law around this recognizes the importance of face-to-face interaction and civilizing the cosmopolitanism that comes from having a rich and diverse place. So for them, creating a destination was a real important element. Now there's a variety of social... Did I skip one? No, great. So there's a variety of social benefits. You know, communities built in that it increases diversity. There's placemaking and sometimes there's historical preservation. I point you to a law review article about the demise of Maxwell Street here in town if you want to learn something about how history was effaced in some regard with the city's tumbling of the market. But social benefits include things like heads-up consumption. There's a lot of empirical work about how when you're shopping in a store, this is the way you shop. You know, your heads down, basically. When you're in a market, it's heads-up consumption. You run across people, Your processes are oriented, yourself is oriented in a fundamentally different way. And of course, youth are involved in a variety of ways, not just in an entrepreneurial way, but in terms of shopping and in terms of sort of fostering their individual capacities to do things on their own. And there's a variety of political benefits. These, in case you are not familiar with them, are found in big cities all over the country. They're the raging grannies. Right? And the raging grannies, what do they rage against? The right-wing politics, basically. But You find them everywhere, and in Madison, you find them singing two or three times a month at the market, singing satirical songs about, so in effect, becoming civically engaged, right? Markets are provide public services of various sorts, but civic engagement and as an additional conduit to public participation, program participation, they revitalize public spaces. They help mitigate risk by providing eyes on the street. You know, interesting that wasn't lost on people with my interest that a street vendor discovered the bomb recently, 4 or 5 months ago in New York City, that prevented it from, or helped prevent that from becoming a disaster. And of course, Jane Jacobs talks about public characters. So they have a variety of public benefits. And with respect to more constitutive aspects of markets, you find, I think, interesting frames for markets. Let me just let you look at it and compare the constitution of a couple public markets with the private market. And you see that the mission statements include just a variety of things. So when people establish a market, they make a lot of different claims about what that market will do. It seems to me that these are the sorts of claims planners want to make about plans that they make, or policymakers want to make about policies that they have, that they will cut across silos, that they will have synergistic, they will produce synergistic opportunities for diverse populations. But the point I want to make with respect to mission statements is that the governance of markets, that the ways that they can be organized by public or private or hybrid actors are many. That firm regulatory hands are not the only way to constitute a market. That self-organization is as important as any other form of governance. And I actually, the research I can point to about that is coming out this December in JPR. I shared it with Charlie. Talking about trying to impart to people that there are a variety of tools at our disposal when constituting markets. And then there's a number of health and environmental benefits. And here, the people in public health are really ahead of the game. They are really looking at food access and cost and making program participation effective by utilizing electronic benefits transfer machines in farmers markets especially. Markets are noted for increasing physical activity and making places walkable as opportunities to impart nutritional education and health information to people, increasing the psychological well-being of a place, and connecting rural and urban interests. Pardon me. So, how might planners harness some of these benefits? Well, I think the way that planners or policymakers go about any planning process, asking first, what are the goals that we have so that we might harness to a market? Do the goals include social goals like enlivening a neighborhood, economic goals like providing employment, providing recreation or shopping opportunities? And in particular, I would urge us to think about how it is a market, being what it is, different things to different people, how it, then markets can be harnessed to articulate across city agencies with other city or other jurisdictions' sponsored goals. Now, whenever you've got an idea, of course, you need to think about the SWOT, right? Which I'm not entirely wedded with the notion itself, but I mean, clearly we need to think about what resources we have available. What are the strengths or weaknesses? What opportunities might there be? And of course, the more people you can get looking at your plans, the more complete this sort of picture will be. And irrespective of how many threats you find, you might decide, I want to try it anyways. In which case, partnerships are absolutely essential. Those partnerships can be between organizations and cities. So, for instance, the federal government now has promulgated an ordinance that permits a market on any federal property. All you have to do is go to the property manager and say, I want to put a market here. And the property manager, there's a federal, there's an actual federal rule now that says that the property owner can make it available to you. They don't have to do anything but make it available to you, but they can make it available to you. So partnerships might be just simply between a group of merchants, as in the case when a small, kind of spontaneous, what looked like our spontaneous markets, but just small groups of people getting together and starting a farmer's market someplace. So partnerships can be of various sorts at different levels. Now those partnerships adopt goals appropriate to their level of organization. And those goals can vary, contingent on the players involved. And the players will then try and adopt, I would hope, a governance strategy that reflects their context. So in some cases, that governance strategy may be very sketchy. That is to say, let's get together at 8 o'clock this Saturday and sell some stuff, right? As in the case of a neighborhood, when several neighbors in a neighborhood get together and say, let's have a big neighborhood garage sale. Somebody put it on Craigslist. Voila, right? There it goes. Or more very complex governance, as if you look at the ordinances for public markets in the city of Chicago, you know, a section of code that's been with the city since 1912. So the governance can vary a great deal from place to place. Yes?
I'm guessing that your statement about the federal government allowing markets on rural lands,
yes,
it does have restrictions as far as, say, parkland or nature preserves.
The restrictions are federal properties. So on federal properties, in any federal office building, that parking lot or plaza or public space can be, you can request the building manager of that federal property. Every federal property of that sort has a building manager. You can go to them and say, I want to have a market here. And the manager, if you Google it when you leave here, you can get to the rule real easy. 2 years ago, they sent it around to a bunch of people to look at the draft rule, and it came out not this last summer, but the summer before. And so cities around the country, we've seen more and more markets spring up. Cities around. Does that answer your question?
I was thinking more along the lines of, for instance, you can bring in 20 trucks into a nature preserve instead of a market in Belo Oak.
Right, no. These are only for federal buildings.
Okay.
These are only federal buildings, not any federal property. I'm sorry if I misspoke. These are federal buildings like Plaza, you know, a federal parking or an outdoor plaza in front of a courthouse or something like that. Now,
military bases, FBI, CIA?
The Pentagon has a farmer's market now. So, now, there's different things you can say, right? We could have a conversation about that. But, in short, I would say yes and let the public push the limits of that ordinance, which, if you read it, or that federal rule, if you read the rule, it's very much open to be pushed. Right. So, and of course, if possible, you'd like the governance, the goals, and the partnerships to articulate with broader citywide goals and strategies that might be found in master plans, or that might be found in other sort of big governing documents for the city. Are there other questions? Feel free to stop me at any point. I'm sorry, I talk kind of fast too, but in any case, like I said, I'd be happy to share with you the paper this is from. Now, I have an optimistic takeaway because my glass, although it's running dry, is always half full, right? So my takeaway for practicing planners is that marketplaces make dynamic and vibrant places by providing a mix of experiences and diversions, commercial options that appeal to a wide variety of people, and we should avoid it in every way possible to take those various segments and try to attribute to them a similar motive for being at the market. Right? People are going to have a whole bunch of different ideas for being in public. And they provide visceral and visual experiences across time and season. They really, in this regard, they contrast a great deal with the sort of more sanitized experience that you experience in a mall, right? Similar, right? But distinct. And I think very importantly, in contrast to private festival marketplaces or malls or similar commercial developments, markets unconsciously bridge the goals of state and society, or only semi-consciously, right? Not everybody share all the same goals, but everybody's out there pursuing the thing that they want to be doing at the time. Now, for academics, I think there's a lot of research questions of interest for us. In some regards, I liken the academic situation, to a sophisticated version of the scholarship that was happening in 1910 around markets. So 100 years ago, people were thinking about markets. There's a book, Marketplaces for the People, 1914. There's a book about markets. So for about 15 years, markets had some cachet in the scholarly literature. And 100 years ago. And currently, I've been doing this work for 17 years. But over the last 5, there's been a notable increase of interest in markets. Not only is the federal government counting farmers' markets, but there's a variety of other things. But I think that we need more attention and more rigorous attention. So, for instance, even though we're enumerating farmers' markets, and there's about 7,000 of them right now, in 1996 we started enumerating, there's about 1,600. Now there are more than 7,000. We're not enumerating all of their close kin of farmers' markets. Street markets of different sorts, swap meets of different sorts, et cetera, et cetera. And there's some very large swap meets and street markets around the country. Up until 1940, street vendor, was a census occupation category. It's possible that it should be again. NAICS, right? There's a NAICS category for non-store retail. But you cannot disaggregate that non-store retail category. And I think that we should be able to. And of course, this question has implications across the whole variety of census and otherwise motivated data collection strategies, right? Like the SIP, the Survey on Income Program Participation, other sorts of big data sets that are collected regularly. There have been there's two Detroit area studies. Y'all may be familiar with that big data collection of Detroit that's been ongoing for 40 years.
Yeah, we've got that Chicago area study here.
Do we have a Chicago area study? Yeah. Well, it would be interesting given that within 20 miles of us, 25 miles of us, there's 100 of these things.
Uh-huh.
But there's 100 markets within 25 miles of us. Indoor swap meets, swaparamas, farmers markets, free markets, there's at least 100. It would be interesting to incorporate some questions on an ongoing basis there. Now, I think there's a host of research on individuals and households. I've done some work on this, but goodness gracious, I've barely scratched the surface. There's some other folks who've done some work on this, but there's just a lot to learn about business formation and organization, about gender and ethnic and health linkages to these things, about supply chain analysis and forward linkages to what happens with the income. You know, how is it invested in different for human capital purposes or other sorts of purposes, and questions go on and on about individual and households, neighborhoods and networks. Gosh, you know, in American Journal of Sociology, 56 years ago, there was an article called "On Institutional Completeness," which was about neighborhoods, which was about and basically a lot of the taken for granted poverty literature of the last 40 years is basically about the absence about how impoverished neighborhoods basically evince the absence of complete institutions, that is to, you know, say, thriving religious or political or economic spaces of different sorts. And so how might networks be part of that? What is the carrying capacity of the neighborhood for a market? What is the carrying capacity for a community? If Chicago had the same number of markets per capita as Toronto, it would have about 3 times the number. There would be about 300 marketplaces in this area. The city would have about 60 farmers markets. Constitution, regulation, development. Everybody knows, everybody has always known, really, that markets, either in the abstract or as places in the sense that I'm talking about them, everybody has always known that markets are social constructions. Whether you look at the literature on the social construction of financial markets or housing markets or public markets like this, you find social framework underlying them, or political constitution. And so the various templates and models for producing markets, I think, are vitally interesting to investigate. Very important, because you might say that the last 60 years has been an integument of the economic activity of the last 60 years is this brief integument between stretches of markets, right? Markets were dominant for 5 centuries before, and then you had this brief integument of 60 years of storefront retail and malls and whatnot, and now a lot of those are getting repurposed and getting shoved away, and markets are again coming back. Now, what does that really mean? Oh, you know, goodness, I know eBay and the internet and different things. But to me, this is just a segmentation. This is a question of a vast number of niches in the ecology that are getting repopulated, and either repopulated or populated in new ways, but with new activities. And in this regard, let me give you an example about, for instance, community land trusts, okay, and how markets, through the constitutional regulation process, tie not only rural to urban in the sense that I spoke of earlier, but foster the economic prospects of a neighborhood, and on top of all that, enhance the entrepreneurial, or that's also economic, the sort of regionalization, the political regionalization of a place. The example I want to share with you is Ann Arbor. Okay. Ann Arbor, Michigan, like most cities in the U.S., had a farmer's market that started in the 19-teens. And that market went on for about 50 years, sort of up and down, you know, more or less popular. In the 1970s, the city of Ann Arbor said, you know what, this market is shall we keep it or shall we lose it? You know, in the 1970s, it's sort of the heyday of malls. Markets might have been at their lowest ebb, but they said, no, let's keep it. You know, we won't put any resources into it, but we should kind of maybe constitute a little voluntary board, oversight board to it. And then in the 1980s in Ann Arbor, that board said, you know, this area that the market is in could be utilized for, the market could be the core of a whole new retail development. And so they did a bunch of new retail development. And that began becoming successful. But then the farmers, you know, as Ann Arbor started growing out, farmers started losing their land, the farmers started saying, you know what, this is getting more expensive. We're having to drive further, and I'm not sure if my kids are going to get to stay in agriculture because the population pressure is going to increase the land values, and it's going to want everybody to sell out. And so what they did was they created another board that created community land trust that tied the interests of the markets to the interests of agriculturalists. In the 1990s, they created this community land trust that sort of, in effect, is a nascent regionalization impulse, right, politically. But it secured people's economic prospects and fostered the growth of that regional food economy, which, you know, a small sideline is Zingerman's Deli, which sources, if you've never been to Ann Arbor, if you've never been to Zingerman's Deli, sure, they get stuff from everywhere, but they pride themselves on a lot of local products as well. And so it started, so the market started sending out its feelers, not just into the politics of the region, but the economy of the region. And so over these 20 or 30 years, these constitutional aspects and these regulatory aspects have helped weave together the economy in a new way. Okay, so last thing, am I doing it right? Here we go. Thank you very much for your attention. I sure appreciate it. There I am, 20 years ago.
How strange you wearing a fanny pack.
I'm not wearing my fanny pack, and I left my good hat at home. But thank you for your attention. I really appreciate y'all coming.